Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beaten Track Podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu Whiffin. It's another day, therefore it's another episode. Today's episode, I sit down with Martin Ware. Martin Ware of Heaven 17, Martin Ware of the Human League, producer of Terence Trent D'Arby, Tina Turner, etc., etc., etc. We go into it all, so you're in for a real treat today. Really is one of Sheffield's finest. Before we get on with the episode, a big thank you to Scroobius Pip, and all my brothers and sisters at the Distraction Pieces Network. I'd also like to thank 76 for producing this podcast. Also, if this is your first time listening to Off the Beaten Track, then all I suggest is when you get to the end of today's episode with Martin, go and have a look in the archives, because it's about 250 episodes now that you can get stuck into, and there's some amazing guests that have been on there. We touch on a few in today's chat. We mentioned Andy McCluskey of OMD, but you can also hear me chatting to guests as diverse as Tommy Lee of Motley Crue, Fatboy Slim, actors like Maxine Peake, Joe Hartley, Melanie C of the Spice Girls. There's a real cross-section of wonderful creatives that I have some smashing chats with. And if you'd like to get even more content and support the podcast, then there is a Patreon. It's Patreon, patreon.com/ Off the Beat and Track. And if you go over there, you get access to yet another couple of hundred shows. And each week I put up radio shows and video episodes and such. And it just goes in the pot to support the podcast from, I think it's about 71p a week. So, yeah, you can find out about all of these things at www.offthebeatandtrackpodcast.com. That's beat and, not beaten, beatandtrackpodcast.com. Let's get back to today's episode. Please enjoy Off the Beaten Track Podcast with the wonderful Martin Ware. Right, I've got to take a quick break in this podcast because I've got some super exciting news. Off the Beaten Track Podcast is proud to go into partnership with the Cacao Bar from Hotel Chocolat. That's right. The Cacao Bar is not a chocolate bar. It's all the best bits of a chocolate bar put into a really exciting new alcoholic range. That's right. Gin, vodka, and a beautiful range of cream liqueurs. So one of the big bonuses of this partnership is obviously I'm super thrilled to have Hotel Chocolat working with us, but they sent me a great big box of this stuff. And I'm telling you, it's amazing. Go and check it out, www.hotelchocolat.com, or over on the socials at Hotel Chocolat. But yeah, in the coming months, there's going to be opportunities for you to get involved with competitions with us, to win bottles of stuff. There's loads of exciting things coming soon, and I can't be more happy to say that this podcast is in partnership with the Cacao Bar from Hotel Chocolat. All right, let's get back to the podcast.
It's Off the Beaten Track Podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network with me, Stu Whiffin.
Okay, we are recording. Joining me today via the means of Zoom, Martin Ware. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm not bad. And the conversations now, it appears that, I mean, we've never met before, and we're recording this at the tail end of January. In the thick of a lockdown 1, 2, 3 or whatever it is, I don't know. So I'm just sort of, no one sort of says, "Oh, hello, nice day today, isn't it?" Nobody talks about the weather anymore. There's one thing that you have to kickstart your conversations with, and it appears to be that kind of ever looming pandemic that we're in the midst of at the moment. And so, what I want to ask you before we talk records, Martin, is just how you found the last 10 months as both a human being and a creative.
It's been very difficult for me. We were just about to embark on our busiest ever year performing live with Heaven 17. together with all the work I do with Illustrious and my Soundscape work, that all got cancelled. We've had, I think, 45 gigs cancelled so far. And in the midst of this, my brother died of COVID. So it's not been great, I have to say. And not only that, I mean, I'm a member of the Ivers Academy board, so you know, which is, for those of you who don't know, is connected with the Ivers Songwriting Awards, but also it's a artist rights lobby group, the biggest one in Britain. And so I'm in touch with a lot of people who are of a similar, you know, like members of the Ivers Academy, but also some quite famous people. Everybody's struggling exactly the same. I'm also principal of a MA course in commercial songwriting and production. And the poor students, you know, I feel for them massively, because, of course, one of the main reasons for a lot of international students coming to London was their networking possibilities in London, and, you know, the sheer number of gigs and, you know, and co-writing possibilities and the vast diversity of the musical ecosystem in London, which they were coming to experience. And of course, they've been locked in the bedroom. Everything's on Zoom.
Do you think that punk ethos will kick in at this point, though? And, you know, with what you have at your disposal, which is Zoom and things like that, do you think, you know, people have gone and sort of had to rethink how they approach these things and use that kind of punk mindset of DIY and what can I do with what I've got?
Yeah, I mean, people are resourceful, but it's not the same, is it? I mean, I'll give you an example. Like, for some of our students, a lot of what they do is about collaborative writing together. They can do that on Zoom. Not on Zoom, but like they can exchange files, etc., and work on things together. So, yeah, the important thing is that people are resourceful. Young people are resourceful, but they feel kind of a justifiable resentment about the way the world is treating them. And some of it is, obviously, you can't control the pandemic, but some of it is about the way that in this world we're looking at, that young people are undervalued and under cared for, in my view. And I just cannot see the sense in it. I just think it's purely dystopian, actually, to blame. I mean, there's a lot of blame for young people inherent in the press and the media in Britain. I just find it incredible. I loathe it, actually. Yeah. I no longer read newspapers. I don't read I don't listen to any radio or TV news anymore. I just get my news from selected news outlets on the internet.
I think that's a really important thing to do, Martin. I'd done that maybe 3 weeks into it, because it was just projecting negativity and fear. And it was like, do you know what? I don't need this. Like, this is a strange enough environment to adjust to as it is. I don't need endless news feeds of just fear and a lot of bollocks. I'm just not into it.
I love that concept of the word that somebody came up with on Twitter, doom scrolling.
Yeah, you know about it's a great word, isn't it?
So it's like, and then somebody did an advert for Iceland, you know, tourist board or something, and it said, don't doom scroll anymore. And they designed this thing. And it said, some people had gone, every day, the average person doom scrolls through 22 meters
on
Twitter. On average, and said, instead of that, we're going to they designed this thing where you scroll through and it's just beautiful photos of waterfalls and the Icelandic countryside and stuff like that. Exactly the same amount, 22 meters of it, as an antidote. I really like that, because I'm a positive person. I like to help positivity in the world. I like to help people. I'm a socialist. I'm a proud socialist. God knows how we got into a situation where being a socialist is regarded as a kind of taboo subject.
Oh, no, it's crazy.
In the media. I mean, even now I get a residual kind of, you know, it's not guilt. It's like, should I even say I'm a socialist anymore in this country? I'm not worried about the consequences. That's not, but it's just, it's like, it's so pervasive, all the media now. Everything is what I perceive to be right wing compared to my kind of left leaning. I'm hardly a socialist worker, kind of sandwich board wearer. You know, I'm a normal guy. I grew up in Sheffield, which is, you know, jokingly referred to as the Socialist Republic of South Yorkshire. Mm-hmm. But it really was. You know, my dad's a trade unionist. He worked in a steelworks all his life. The other members of HEM 17, Glenn's dad worked in a steelworks all his life. Ian's dad was a builder all his life. They were all trade unionists, proud working men who had a function and a purpose in their lives, which enabled them to support their family. What's wrong with that?
Nothing.
Together with the fantastic, kind of welfare state and the NHS, etc., which has now been appropriated by the Tories so that they can run it into the ground and asset strip it for their mates who don't even pay tax in this country.
Yeah.
So that's very patriotic, isn't it?
Yeah.
So fuck them all, is what I say.
Yeah, yeah. And you won't find any love for Tories on this podcast.
Yeah, yeah. I got contacted by some people who are close to Corbyn and various other people at the left of the left, shall we say, within the Labour Party and outside the Labour Party, to see if there's a new way we can represent socialism. And so I've been kind of talking to them, had a couple of Zoom calls. We all know the problem is we'll split the Labour Party. So, and therefore, the argument is that we'll never get into power again. I personally, if it was me, I'd say just go for it. Because the main things that need changing in this country are, as far as I'm concerned, proportional representation. There needs to be a written constitution before these things happen, and there needs to be a representative second house. If those things don't happen, then nothing's really ever going to change anyway.
Absolutely, absolutely. Mike, I'm going to ask you for your first record, and for track one, I'm going to ask you what you regard as the song that has the greatest ever intro, please.
Oh yeah, right. Well, I do quite a lot. Obviously not during COVID times, but I do quite a lot of DJing, and I'm a big soul fan, as well as electronic music, and I've got very eclectic tastes, but the one intro that I find thrilling, and I often use to launch my sets just to surprise people if they think it's just going to be like, you know, all the kind of late 70s, early 80s electronics pop hits, is I start with a kind of filtered version of In the Stone by Earth, Wind and Fire, which I just think is the most thrilling intro to any track ever.
It's glorious, Martin. And I've got to be honest with you, I hadn't heard that until you sent your songs over.
And, you're joking.
I haven't, no. I'd say I'm a soul fan as well, but for some reason, that record had just completely passed me by. It's a majestic opening, isn't it? And it's a perfect thing to kick off a DJ set with.
Well, it really is. And in fact, I went to see them about 5 years ago at the O2. And they opened their entire set with that. And it was just like a massive celebration. The entire audience, 12,000 whatever, were on their feet, cheering. Oh, what a thrill.
I always ask musicians this question. I've struggled for 2 years to actually phrase the question right, but bear with me, Martin. So I'm always interested as to how the way that people listen to music now has affected the way that people make music. So where I'm going with this is the early days of the Human League and Heaven 17, yeah. And the music you was making then, people would theoretically buy that on vinyl or cassette. Yeah. And now, obviously, people are now listening via streaming services. And what we've also seen over the years is with, I guess, more in the pop market, attention spans are becoming slightly shorter. And we live in a very, as you know, as we touched on, doom scrolling and 20 meters of scrolling. So, you know, it's very fast fix. And so what I'm saying is when you work in songwriting, you know, workshops and things like that now, I'm hearing more pop music now that starts with a chorus. There's absolutely no fat on the bone. I just wonder if that, the way that people are listening to music now, has affected how you approach songwriting.
It hasn't, funnily enough, because my view is, having been doing this for 40 years and having worked with some of the world's best performers and songwriters, I know what works, and it's eternal. I'm not saying everything has to be traditional song structures. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is there are certain paradigms that always work in whatever context you want to put them into. So if you go chasing your tail, like go, right, well, people are only going to listen to the first, so I'm just going to do that, and the rest of it is really just the, you know, just to make up time. What's the point?
Yeah,
you might as well do 1 minute tracks.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the logical outcome of that. And I don't believe that's the case. I think people want to go on a small emotional journey that makes them, at the end of the track, want them to put the track on again at the start. And that theory translates into many different contexts.
And it was speaking to who was I speaking to on here that was explaining, it was Andy McCluskey, and he was saying about how pop music to get on the was saying that pop music now to get on the radio, the vocal has to be in by X amount of seconds and things like that, and it just made me think, you know. So he said Enola Gay wouldn't have got, you know, wouldn't get mainstream radio play now because of the vocal doesn't kick in for however many seconds it is. And just looking at that Earth, Wind and Fire track, you know, it's a huge, majestic intro. But would that get, you know, mainstream radio play now, a song with an intro as grand and as long as that? I don't know.
Well, no. But then, you know, what does Radio 1 play? What does Radio 2 play?
Yeah.
You know, the way that they've, in Britain, the way that it's turned is from, we were world leaders in songwriting and new forms of pop, which would be supported by that, you know, national network of radio stations, even commercial stations.
Sure.
Not for any altruistic sense, just because we were good at it and it sounded great and they had a great number of listeners. And it's when the in the 90s all those outlets started getting taken over by the by the kind of dance fraternity,
sure,
frankly, that it all started going downhill a bit. I love dance music, like the next person, and I think Hem 17 and the early Human League have inspired quite a few kind of 90s and noughties DJs.
Absolutely,
but it kind of got too powerful, you know. So now we end up with Radio 1 and Radio 1 Extra, which is fundamentally, you know, either banal kind of formulate pop or just dance kind of not very good songs,
yeah,
dance based, more beats based. Radio 2 is basically regarded as a nostalgia station,
yeah,
which is ridiculous. The only one that's worth anything is Radio 6, as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, you know. 6 music is a glorious place to be. It really is.
Well, it is, because, you know, there's still you're still not quite sure what's coming next.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of the people who present the programs, I mean, you know I've been on Stuart McConey's show a few times and Ratcliffe, and they're friends of mine, and you know, that sums up where we should be at. I've got a story for you, actually, which is I was working a few years ago with LaRue, mm-hmm. who's a friend, with Hem 17, and she quoted us as one of her big influences. And so radio, one of the radio BBC radio producers had this idea. He wanted to produce this series of collaborations between new artists and you know, previous generation artists, mm-hmm. As a mutual thing, film it at Maida Vale and put it on the red button on the telly. And it turned out to be a massive success. We did three of her songs, three of our songs, and she sang on our songs and we sang on her songs and so on. And it was our band and blah, blah, blah. Massive success. And that ended up being a big success. It was the biggest thing ever on the red button in music.
Wow.
Yeah, this was about 5 or 6 years ago. And it beat Robbie Williams, Glastonbury. And so, you know, there are still innovative producers out there. And this was supported also by Radio 6, by the way. That's why I mentioned it. There are still innovative ways to get the message out there. But I believe, in my absolute 100% certainty in my heart, that there needs to be mainstream TV and radio in Britain. It doesn't have to be national broadcasters. I don't care who does it. That caters for people who just want to hear songs. That's not in a particular kind of, you know, in a particular genre. Yeah. You don't have to listen to absolute 80s, for instance. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, if you looked at people's listening habits or collections or whatever they have on their phone,
yeah, Pimble everywhere,
on Spotify, whatever they do, everybody's got eclectic taste.
Yeah.
Everybody, no exceptions. Nobody listens just to you know, trap all day, or nobody listens. Well, maybe some people listen to classical music all day, but you know, basically, most people have a wide range of taste nowadays, I believe.
I couldn't agree more.
Where the fuck is that radio station? Excuse my language.
No, I mean, it is. Six is the closest you're going to get.
Mm.
I mean, just...
And so anyway, that leads back to my the reason I mentioned this was... It's not the listening habits of the public that define the sort of songs that being made. It's where you can get those songs played,
yeah,
for the general public.
Definitely. And I've got a quick story for you, Martin, regarding what you just said. This very question, song with the greatest ever intro, last year I had Ellie on this podcast, and she chose Heaven 17.
Oh, which one?
I can't remember. I was trying to think when it popped in my head, and I thought, which one did she go for? But she definitely chose Heaven 17 as a track for her greatest ever intro, and she went on at length about her love of the band.
Oh, God bless her. I go on at length. She's been on my podcast as well. So.
Okay. Yeah. Track two, Martin, the first song you remember that had an emotional impact on you, please.
You've Lost That Lovely Feeling. I remember listening to it when I was listening to the radio under the sheets at home when I was about 8 years old, and I used to drift in and out on Radio Luxembourg. I love the kind of epic nature of it and the kind of baritone voice of the guy from, I can't remember his name now, from Righteous Brothers. And the fantastic production. We're not allowed to talk about Phil Spector now because he's a total arsehole.
That's a weird situation, isn't it? It's, you know, I found that really weird because musically, you know, it was some of the stuff he'd done with some of the, you know, as an artist was incredible, but you just can't. It's a really strange one. You can't, I think the nature of what you've done, it's impossible for me to separate the art from the man.
I mean, as far as I'm concerned, you know, he's worse than Gary Glitter, and I've worked with Gary Glitter as well.
Yeah.
I mean, it's horrific. Yeah, not only is he a murderer, but he forced his children to watch sexual acts. Mm. I mean, he's a paedophile. And that's what, you know, excessive. Don't do drugs, kids. That's what excessive cocaine use will do for you.
Yeah.
But obviously, the guy was a complete arsehole, you know. And sometimes that comes with genius, you know.
Yeah.
I have to say, you know, he invented an entire sound, which I was totally in love with. I mean, you know, I'd say You've Lost That Loving Feeling and touched me in a real way, and so did River Deep Mountain High. And I went on to work with Tina, of course, you know, later.
Martin, I saw Heaven 17 tail end of last year at South End Cliffs. Not tail end of last year, was it? It would have been the year before. Yeah. At Cliffs Pavilion with Squeeze. And I saw you perform this very song, the Righteous Brothers. And I just wondered, I know it was recorded by the Human League. Was that your suggestion? Was that that early love of that record that you suggested to the band that you record it?
Yeah. Phil isn't a natural fan of soul music. Mm-hmm. I'm the kind of soul guy in the original Human League, and yes, it was my suggestion. We actually did a kind of demo instrumental attempt at River Deep Mountain High as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which has never seen the light of day, I don't think. It totally electronic in that form. So we were trying all sorts of things out at that point. But what we wanted, what we realised in our early performances with the Human League, you know, when we're still playing tiny, tiny venues, was we needed something to emotionally engage the audience.
Yeah.
Oh, hold on a sec. We needed something to emotionally engage the audience and surprise them. Mm-hmm. And we couldn't think of anything much more surprising than doing something that's like, you know, the kind of enemy Connie Shenty would regard as being kind of cheesy.
Sure.
And that, but actually, the emotional nature of the kind of desolation of the electronic soundscape that we created for it matched, for me, the true meaning of the emotional meaning of the song. In a different way to the original backing, obviously, but in just as good a way, I feel.
Listen up. I've only got another new sponsor, Eggfried. It's this super cool clothing label. And if you're into sort of skating and street art and gigging and kind of like really cool art and throwing a little bit of Asian culture and the designer's kind of weird sense of humour in the mix, then you're pretty much there with the wonderful world that is eggfried.com. Now, they do these amazing punchy kind of graphic tees, hoodies and sweatshirts, beautiful art prints, as well as this, they have a denim range, all handmade in-house, all supporting the slow fashion movement. Not only that, they've given you a discount code, 10% off when you head over to eggfried.com. Just use the code EGGSALAD, EGGSALAD, save 10%. Go and get lost in the world of Eggfried. Also, they've got a new kids range, and it's called Small Fried, and it's super cool, super cute. And again, it's all over there in this wonderful world. Go and get involved at eggfried.com. For track three, Martin, I'm going to ask you, I'm going to keep you in the earlier days and the formative years. I'm going to ask you for a song that reminds you of your time at school, please.
Yeah. I met Phil Oakey at school when he moved to my grammar school in Sheffield. And he introduced me to lots and lots of stuff. And he was the first person who ever played me this track. And it reminds me of our school days in the common room, which was Space Oddity by David Bowie. I'm a massive Bowie fan, obviously. Mm-hmm. And we used to... We used to have like house parties at his house because his parents were often out of town, and we had the house to ourselves, and he had a posh house and we didn't have a posh house. So, and he was one of the first people I knew who had an 8-track cartridge player. And this meant that we could have all night parties And he had all the early Bowie albums. And we, for the first time ever, we could put an album on and it would play continuously forever. And we used to do that with Space Oddity. But the particular track itself, I love, because it had, you know, a stylophone on it. And the stylophone was my first ever electronic instrument.
Was it?
Yeah.
Wonderful.
And not only that, I had a two-stylus stylophone, which was like a real kind of prosumer product at the time. Nobody, hardly anybody knew had got one. I think you can get one on eBay now, and they charge like a grand for them or something. And I thought I was Eno, you know.
Your stylophone.
Seriously. That was my first synthesizer, yeah.
I mean, how was school? Did you enjoy it?
Not really, no. The grammar school I went to, which is King Edward VII School in Sheffield, is a big kind of Victorian neoclassical edifice, it was like a wannabe private school. So all the masters had gowns. Most of them were totally disengaged and were just waiting to retire, you know.
Yeah.
And there were a couple of them that were really incredibly violent and used to cane people as they had a sexual predilection for it, I presume. Yeah. I got caned for no apparent reason one day by our divinity teacher, Mr. Baker. May he rot in hell. I presume he's dead now. Who used to take a run-up. But he always used to make sure that nobody witnessed what he did.
That's so dark, isn't it?
I'm pretty sure he got a sexual thrill out of it, yeah.
Terrifying. Terrifying.
And, you know, you couldn't find anybody more compliant than me. Yeah. I mean, I was a very quiet lad.
So, did you have any kind of... I mean, was you a creative kid?
Good question. No, not really. We didn't have any instruments in the house, musical instruments. I didn't even know I'd got a kind of talent, to be honest. I did recorder and choir at school. I could sing a bit, but I had no real kind of ambition to be a musician. And it was really electronic music and like Roxy music, I suppose, lit the fuse for me. And
That's the second time you sort of touched on Eno. So when you'd hear them, like Roxy Records and Bowie and stuff like that, was there any part of your creative brain that was kicking in at an early age that would sort of maybe sort of look at how them records were being put together? Would you sort of, you know, deconstruct anything, or was you just listening to them on face value at that point?
I was looking at stuff, anything that had a kind of futuristic attitude to it.
Yeah.
Or an unusual sound. So I was naturally attracted from a very early age to anything with a synthesizer in it, for a start.
Yeah.
I couldn't really put into words why. I still don't really fully understand why, but except I grew up in the 60s, which is like a highly futuristic age with the space race. And
yeah,
that was the main thing on the TV all the time, is like every moonshot, every, you know, it was like, oh, 1 year, you know, and then Tomorrow's World, and what will the world be like in the year 2000, which sounded impossibly far away. And it was a very kind of lying in the gutter, looking at the stars time, you know.
Did you have any idea what you wanted to do with your life?
I still don't. I've never had a plan, no. I never, to be honest, never even really considered it a possibility to be in a band, you know, a commercial, a signed band. It came as a massive surprise.
Well,
because there were loads of bands in Sheffield who really, really wanted to be signed and were desperate. And they just didn't have that. And we were going, well, we don't really give a fuck, you know.
That's interesting.
And then we got signed, and like everybody hated us. No, it's not quite true, but, you know, there was a lot of resentment.
I find that really interesting because, you know, the music industry is famously a very difficult business to, you know, succeed in and maintain success. And so I normally like to ask guests at this point, like, you know, are you driven? I mean, it sounds like at that point you wasn't. You know, I mean, tell me otherwise. But, you know, did the drive sort of kick in as the band started to kind of get success?
No, the drive kicked in as soon as we had a record out, and we realised that people liked what we did.
Yeah.
It's that simple. And then you go, this is the opportunity we've all been waiting for, now going to devote our entire time and effort and mental acuity to making this work.
As I touched on earlier, I saw you on stage 2019, you know, coming from behind the synth and singing and looking incredibly confident. Was you a confident young man?
Was I a confident young man? No, not at all. I was bullied at school. I was very quiet. I always had a degree of kind of I was willing to try things out. You know, I've never been frightened to have a go at things.
Mm.
And I always wanted to be different to other people. I suppose that was an impetus as well. I didn't want to follow the crowd. I always had this innate feeling that I wanted to be different in some way. And that manifests itself with hanging out with people who felt in felt similarly. And we found, I was very lucky to find a whole bunch of my peers who felt the same, like Glenn, Ian, all at this thing called Meat Whistle, which was like a youth drama arts project thing.
Tell us a little bit about that. Martin, what was that?
It was an amazing thing. It was paid for by the council in Sheffield. It was in an old derelict, not quite derelict, empty school building just behind the City Hall in Sheffield. And basically, it was two people, Chris and Veronica Wilkinson, who were actors, who managed to wheedle some money out of the and the property. Out of the Labour Council and said, look, we want to do this youth project, which gives an outlet for a creative outlet for kids who are maybe not part of the normal run-of-the-mill kind of Sheffield thing. And so they went round, they actually publicised it in all the secondary schools and said, look, you can come here on the weekends or like one afternoon a week and try it out, you know. Ostensibly, it was drama, but actually it turned into imaginary bands messing about, basically, in any creative form you could.
Oh, that sounds incredible.
Yeah, it changed my life. Literally, it was the turning point of my life.
Well, let's pick another record and let's stay again in those early days. And for track four, Martin, the first song you remember buying from a record shop?
Yeah, I'm not encouraging anybody to do this, by the way, but when I was young, I used to, there was a gang of three or four of us just when I started going into town to look at record stores, and they used to have sales on, and they used to have in the summer and at Christmas, they used to have sales on of stock that was spoilt in some way. Like a lot of the times kids had nicked some covers from albums, for instance.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. Anyway, there was a whole rack of 50p singles that had not got their picture covers or whatever, or any covers. And it was 20th Century Boy by T-Rex.
What a track that is.
Which, again, has one of the great intros of all time.
Yeah, 100%.
And I actually went to see T-Rex at the City Hall. And it was still, to this day, the best gig I've ever seen.
Really?
Yeah.
It's really interesting that you said that, you know, you just felt like you wanted to be different, and you know, and you found your peers, you know, you found your tribe, you know, at that time, and
yeah.
And you know, that must have been encouraged and influenced by seeing people like Eno, Bowie, Bolan,
yeah.
You know,
yeah. Well, glam was a massive influence. I mean, you know, Gary Glitter Band.
Mm.
anything that felt kind of futuristic and glamorous. Because, you know, I love Sheffield and the Sheffield people, but it's not a glamorous place.
Mm.
You know, there is a well-off part of Sheffield, but generally it's full of people who are not well-off, you know. Yeah. And so it's not like you want to escape it, because it's actually a pleasant place to live. But it's like you know that you're if you want to fulfil any ambition, you've probably got to leave.
Yeah.
Unless you want to run a steelworks or something, or, you know. Now it's different, because obviously it's become like a lot of repurposed centres for that used to be manufacturing.
Yeah.
It now become a kind of a specialist centre for IT and creativity and stuff. But yeah. So anyway, yeah, that was that. Yeah.
And just talking about, you know, seeing T-Rex, Bolan, you know, Roxy, etc. Like, I'm presuming that would have been sort of on the sofa watching Top of the Pops religiously each week.
Yeah.
And I love to ask guests this. How important was it, and how exciting was it, and was it everything you expected it to be when you got on Top of the Pops?
Top of the Pops was was absolutely essential to be, for yourself, to regard yourself as a pop star.
Yeah.
And also your family and all your friends knew you were on the biggest show for pop music, as far as we were concerned, in the world.
Yeah.
And so, you know, just one appearance, it's a bit like getting one cap for England
yeah.
at football. You know, it doesn't matter. Forever, you're an England international.
Yeah.
Right? The rest is details. You are a pop star. If you've ever been on Top of the Pops, you can claim to be a real pop star. And it was everything we thought it was going to be and more.
Can you remember who else was there the first time you played?
Good question. That it was.
And what was it? And what track was you performing?
Yeah, it was Rock and Roll. Our version of Rock and Roll.
Okay.
Part one, and nightclubbing, and that would have been 79 or 80.
Okay.
And I can't remember who else was on, but I have to say I'm certain on the internet there are sites that can tell you who was on every program.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure that's out there. I always find that, like, when watching Top of the Pops, you know, back then, it just felt for me that anyone that was on there was like walking off of that stage and then getting a Concorde home. Like, no one was getting getting the bus home. It was like, well, you're obviously multi millionaires now.
Yeah. You know, that's a very common thing. The number of people who think if you've been on Top of the Pops that you must be a millionaire. It's just ridiculous. Do you know how much we were earning at that point?
Go on.
We were paying ourselves £30 a week each.
Wow.
I was earning more before I gave up my day job as a computer operator. I was earning twice as much. I took a 50% pay cut to become a pop star.
After your wages to go on Top of the Pops.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh.
And of course, it all pays off in the end. But, you know, I'm saying at that point, we were poor.
Yeah.
Literally poor.
And just touching on record shops, as your career developed and bringing it up to now, how important of record shops and independent record shops been for you?
I've always supported them. I mean, when I was growing up, there was a store called Rare and Racy, which is near where I lived, which was this fantastic second-hand record store that was cheap, so you could buy things on spec just because you like the cover, for instance. And then you could, if you didn't like them, you took them back the next week and got half the kind of label price back. and then buy something else. And that was my musical education. I used to buy all sorts of stuff. Anything that had an interesting cover or looked like it got electronic music on it.
Okay, well, let's bring things forward a few years now. And for track five, I'm going to ask you, Martin, the song that soundtracked your years clubbing.
Yes. This could have been any number. I mean, I spent, you know, 10 years regularly clubbing every weekend. But there's one song that would always get me out of my seat whenever it was on. When I used to go down to the... Penelope's Discotheque in Sheffield, Penny's, and they always used to play an eclectic range of songs, a lot of kind of popular, cooler songs from America, and British songs as well. But the one that got everybody up was Joy and Pain by Mays.
What a record that is.
It's. Have you ever seen them play live?
Whenever I listen to this record, if I add it to anything I do on Spotify, I always add the live version.
Right. Have you ever seen them play live?
I haven't.
Well, I went to see them at the Hammersmith Odeon. I have never been in an audience that was so entranced by an act.
Really?
Yeah, ever. Not entranced, that's the wrong word. So engaged. Literally, the moment they walked on stage, everybody in the auditorium stood up, and it was a seated venue. Everybody, and everybody was dancing.
See,
there wasn't encouragement from the stage. It was, and they're not really dance songs. A lot of the songs,
yeah,
it's like everybody knew all the lyrics. Everybody was singing. It was like everybody was in a nightclub. They were the most popular act I've ever seen in a live environment. Ever.
I would not have expected you to say that. And so is Frankie Beverly a really sort of charismatic front man?
Do you know, there's something really weird. They are so relaxed on stage. There's no kind of patter or, you know, a little bit, but no more, nothing out of the ordinary. It was all about a genuine warmth for the source material from the public. They just loved those songs, and they loved the fact that they were celebrating those songs being performed in like a cathedral of their musical love.
Yeah.
You know, that's all it was. So it wasn't like a kind of panto thing where it's like, yeah, Hammersmith, and like, you know.
Yeah.
No special versions, no like 14-minute guitar solos, nothing. It was all the arrangements pretty much as they were on the records, and the love in the room was, I've never experienced it anywhere else.
Wow. You said there'd be many, because you said, you know, you've done 10 years or so of clubbing.
Yeah.
If you had to sort of throw in some other honourable mentions, have you got any that you'd like to throw in the playlist?
Okay, so, my first clubbing experience, which went on for like about 2 years, was really early doors at a place called the Penthouse Club in Sheffield, where all of us from Meat Whistle went down there. And we used to go down there on student night, which is like where all the drinks were really cheap, which is Tuesday night, I think. 10p drinks night.
That sounds good.
To get a pint of beer, watered down beer for 10p, or a glass of wine, or a single shot and a mixer, or what everybody else did, which I couldn't do because I don't like it, but you could get bottled barley wine, which used to get incredibly drunk. You know, it's a horrible drink. I don't know if you ever had it.
Mm.
But barley wine was very poor. Anyway, at that point, that was very much a glam club. But there's one track, actually, which I just was reminded of the other day. Loads of Bowie and glam and stuff like that, and we'd dance all night. But there's one unusual track that really got everybody up and posing and dancing. And you'd never, if I give you 1,000 picks, you'd never get it.
Okay.
And it was Faith Healer by the sensational Alex Harvey Band.
Oh, really?
And if you've ever heard that on a big... powerful disco system, it absolutely is incredible, because it's like, it's so cinematic. It's like it really sparks the imagination, that track, for me. And I mean, there were things like Panic in Detroit, which all at that point used to get people up, and you know, and John and Money Dancing, and things like that. And then moving on a bit later on, in terms of we used to dance to a lot of Michael Jackson.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, a lot from the Off the Wall. You know,
what a record.
I mean, it's just ridiculous. Don't Stop Till You Get Enough.
For me, that would be as one of the greatest ever intros.
Yeah. I mean, but it's like you're immediately there, aren't you? And you're not going to leave the dance floor till it's finished.
Certainly not.
So, yeah, I mean, that sort of stuff. And then, you know, I mean, there's too many to mention, but that gives you an idea.
Well, before I get on to the next track, there's something that I want to ask you, talking about incredible soul singers and soul music. I just want to know a little bit more about the discovery of Terence Trent D'Arby and your involvement in that. Because that record, when I was going clubbing in the late 80s, when Hardline dropped, you know, it was just, we couldn't get enough of it. And I think today it still sounds like an incredible record. And I just wonder, you know, the story behind your involvement in that.
Yeah, sure. Well, I was doing a lot of production work at that time, and obviously I'd had the big success with Tina, so yeah. I was kind of temporarily hot property, and I turned down a couple of albums with that they offered me a huge amount of money to do, to go to America and record in America with I was offered Rod Stewart's album, and which I turned down because he was a Tory, and
fantastic.
That's a good story, isn't it? It's true as well. And then, more foolishly, I turned down Bette Midler because I thought her career was over. And then she went on to about 10 Grammys. So I know fuck all, basically. You know. The bottom line is I didn't really want to move to America.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't mind visiting America, but I don't want to live there. I enjoy my friends and my family in Britain. You know, I didn't want to leave Britain. Terence. So I was hot property. I was doing loads of third-party production in Britain anyway, so I had plenty of work. And I was just about to start on another project, which I'd had a meeting with Wet, I think, and I didn't really get on with him.
Okay.
He was a bit of an arsehole.
Hmm.
And I don't think they were that keen on me either.
Hmm.
Didn't put much effort into it anyway. It might have been that or somebody else. Anyway, I can't remember. I'd kind of agreed to do another artist. And then I got this panicky phone call from Sony going, from this young A&R man called Lincoln Elias, who turns out he was like 18, right? He said, Martin, he's a really charismatic dude. He said, we've got this amazing artist called Terence Trent D'Arby. I really want you to consider working with him. I'm going to send you a bike over with a cassette. And I said, well, I'm kind of tied up for the next 3 months. I said, just listen to it, trust me. And he sent me the cassette over, and I was absolutely dumbfounded.
What was on that cassette?
What was on the cassette was a whole bunch of songs, none of which made the first album.
Okay.
By the way, it was in the style of Stevie Wonder, but with like kind of Otis Redding, Stevie Wonder complexity of songs, but with a kind of Otis Redding fantastic voice that he had, that kind of Sam Cooke Otis Redding thing going on.
Had you even seen him at this point?
No.
Oh, my God.
No. So, and I immediately rang back and said, I need to come in for a meeting. Can we do it tomorrow morning? And I thought, I knew intuitively this guy was a massive star. Just based on his songwriting and his voice, let alone what he looked like. For all I knew, he could have been he looked like a big dustbin man, you know.
Yeah.
And anyway, I'd never even met the A&R guy. Or we'd never talked before. It turns out, a little side story, it turns out that Lincoln, the reason he asked me, apart from he knew I'd worked with Tina and all that stuff, and liked what I did, when he was at school, 2 years previously, he'd done his final project for his A-levels, A-level music, on BEF, believe it or not, my production company.
Amazing.
I know. Is that fate or what? So he had a natural love of everything that I was doing anyway. And I was just going, oh, this is fucking great. Right, so I went to the meeting. And, of course, Terry is like a god. I mean, literally, he looks like he stepped. You know, he had the style, but also he had the grace, talent, obviously. Every woman wanted to be with him. I mean, you walk down the street and literally women would turn round and look.
I mean, Terence Trent D'Arby did not lack star quality. And a funny sort of story for you as well, Martin, where I live out in Essex, when Terence broke and you know, he seemed to be on everywhere, and you know, wherever you looked, there was Terence Trent D'Arby records. His then girlfriend, I believe, lived in the council estate where I live. And there'd be this really posh car, like, parked up on this very rough estate. And we'd all be, like, going down there on our push bikes, and it'd be like, that's Terence Trent D'Arby. He's gone in that flat. And we'd all be, like, waiting around, hoping to get a glimpse of him coming out the flat to get back in this, like, posh old car with a driver.
Wow.
I'm just going to take you back to Sheffield now for track six. And ask you for your favourite song from an artist from your home county, please.
Yeah, well, is a fellow Sheffield boy who I've always admired, Richard Hawley.
Incredible.
He's such a great musician. He's a fellow Sheffield Wednesday fan, so I see him at the games occasionally. And I've just always had a soft spot for him. Everything he's done, really.
Yeah.
But the one track that I really love above all else is Cole's Corner, primarily because I remember Cole's Corner when I was growing up. It's where you used to meet. Girls used to arrange to meet at Cole's Corner in town. It was the place. And you could go down there and there'd always be a bunch of young people waiting nervously for their dates to turn up. So as a piece of social observation, it's an incredible subject matter. You know, it resonated with me, obviously, but, you know, those places occur in every town.
Yeah.
Right?
And it's a beautiful record, isn't it?
His voice is just, oh. You know, I didn't find out until I did a podcast with him recently. He was really close friends with Scott Walker, for instance.
Really?
Yeah, he was only one of six people invited to Scott's funeral.
Wow.
Yeah.
Was that through the Pulp thing? Because did Jarvis do something with
I think
Scott
so, yeah.
Walker, possibly.
But you know, Richard's a top session player. That's how he met a lot of these people. It's like that secret society of top session players who know each other internationally, you know. He's played on loads of kind of American artists.
Oh, really?
Nashville. Yeah, he's done all that stuff.
Because
listen to my podcast. Episode one.
Well,
episode one with Richard. Electronically yours with Martin Ware.
Right. I'm going to tag that in the bio for this episode. I'm a huge Richard Hawley fan. I got to meet Richard early on a fair few times. My band done a fair few gigs with the Long Pigs. When he was in them, and to then sort of see him pop up in Pulp, and then just to then sort of to see him as a solo artist and just hear that, just I just think he's an absolute talent.
And you know what? He's a totally genuine person who's a proper artist. He can't help it. He's compelled to be an artist.
Wonderful.
You know, he did a musical which was on at the Crucible in Sheffield, a jukebox musical he didn't write it, but it featured his songs.
Really? I didn't know anything about this.
It's called Standing at the Sky's Edge.
Okay.
And I went to see it, And the run, it was on at the Crucible for like a month, and it sold out every seat. And it was just about to transfer to the National and go on tour for a year with the National.
Wow.
And then COVID came along.
All right. You can play DJ now for track 7. A song that many may not know that you would like them to hear.
Okay. Again, there were millions of these because I've got such ridiculous eclectic tastes in music. But there's somebody who I've always been massive. You know, I'm not a big fan of a lot of my peers in music.
Okay.
Not that I don't like them. It's just it's not. I don't necessarily go out and buy the, you know, the other person, the other band's electronic album, for instance. Or something. I'm more interested in, you know, graphic design or photographers or more eclectic music or whatever. But there is one person from who was my peer in the 80s who I've always had massive respect for, which is Green Gartside and Scritability.
What a talent he is.
Oh, and the song that turned me on to this was Faithless from Songs to Remember album. And the 12-inch of that is one of the most beautiful arrangements. You know, like, so you hear somebody and you think, this has just come out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Right up into my top three favourite things of all time. And if you've never heard this, I mean, it's not one of his most not one of his most famous songs.
It's an early one as well, isn't it? It's from like 82, yeah. I think.
Yeah, it's incredible. Just listen to it. The gospel arrangements, the composition shifts around in a almost like a kind of jazz way.
Yeah,
in between different keys. His vocals are so beautiful, and I was lucky enough to work with him, obviously, on various projects. With the BF album that I did with him, we did a Stevie Wonder cover version, and but I also produced a couple of singles that got in the top 10.
What ones were they?
The one with Shabba Ranks.
Okay.
That we did, which was "Take Me in Your Arms and Love Me," was it?
Yeah,
I can't remember. And the one with Sweetie Irie. Or was that "Take Me in Your Arms and Love Me"? Anyway, those two. I think he wanted somebody like me as a producer stroke arranger to take him out of his endless revision. He's one of those people who won't let go of the dart. You know, he will keep working on tracks forever. And I just said, it sounds fucking great. Just do it, you know. But what a voice, by the way.
Incredible voice. And when you sent that over, I just went down a complete hole of listening to Scritti Pilitti again. And what's interesting, in that early stuff, I'm not sure if it's on this track or the track that followed it on the album, he messes around with like a vocoder effect.
Yes.
And then fast forward to, I guess, mid to late 80s, he recorded recorded with Roger Troutman of Zap Band. Was it Boom Meshi?
He loved Zap.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I just thought it was hearing, I'd never heard him with the vocoder so early on. I thought he'd obviously heard Zap or whatever. And then, yeah, fast forward however many years. And yeah, he's working with Troutman.
He's an enormous music fan, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
Green. He's a very, very strong fan of dancehall and Jamaican contemporary version of toasting, reggae, whatever you want to call it. So this was his opportunity to work with some of those people, the two tracks that I did with him. But he's also an enormous fan of, as you can tell from Cupid and Psyche, an enormous fan of funk. And kind of song oriented, kind of funky influenced dudes. So we got on really well because that's really a large part of what influenced me as well.
Yeah. Well, what we do, Martin, is we put together a Spotify playlist to accompany this podcast, so people can go through and listen to all your song choices and some of the other tracks that we've chatted about today. As we find ourselves steaming into 2021 in a very, very strange place, what are you looking forward to, you know, with a positive mindset, looking that this year is going to see us hopefully sort of return to an element of a normality? What are you looking forward to personally, and what's happening professionally?
Okay, well, I'm looking forward to walking on stage and seeing an audience again, a real audience.
Yeah.
I didn't realise how much I missed it, to be honest, because you just get on with stuff, don't you? I'm not blasé about any of it. We always have a good relationship with our audiences, and we always appreciate what we do. But, you know, the sharing of communal joy is a very important thing, you know, in my life. And you can either do it as an observer, or you can do it as some, if you're lucky enough, you can do it as somebody who's helping to create that. And that means more to me than anything, more than being in the studio or recording albums or anything like that. As I mentioned, we had over 40 gigs cancelled this year, which have all been mostly rearranged. We were due to do our first proper American tour headlining as well, which has been needs to be rearranged. We were going to do Germany as well. But the most exciting thing that got cancelled 3 days after lockdown was we were going to restage the first two Human League albums with Hem 17.
Wow.
And with full production, full visual production, like the early slideshows and everything, but on a massive scale. We were due to perform it 3 days after lockdown was called at the Roundhouse and Sheffield City Hall. So that's rearranged for late autumn. Hopefully we'll be all right by then, I hope.
Wonderful.
With my 3D soundscape company, Illustrious, I'm currently working on, with my son, Gabriel, who's in the room with me at the moment, who's a composer as well. We're currently working on a three-dimensional sound installation, which is going to be in a gallery on the Grand Canal in Venice.
Wow.
It was due to be on in December last year, but obviously it's had to be postponed for a year. So that's coming up. I'm enjoying doing my podcast series.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great excuse to reconnect with people I've not seen for a while.
And what can people expect from that, Martin?
Lots of famous people. It's basically a load of people that I've stayed friends with over the years, for the last 40 years as a producer.
Mm-hmm.
I just did. I'll tell you a list of people, actually. I think you'll be quite interested with this. Un secondo. excuse me.
And what's the concept of the podcast?
The concept is an informal kind of biographical chat, really.
Yeah.
A bit like this, but except you've got the structure of the songs.
Yeah.
For this, these are all people, generally, that people know anyway.
Mm.
So we don't need to contextualise it in any way. So last week I had Glenn Matlock on, for instance.
Wonderful.
And so far we've had Richard Hawley, Ellie Jackson, Glenn Gregory, of course. Sandy Shaw.
Wow.
Graham Fellows, you know, John Shuttleworth.
Mm-hmm.
Animatronic from Scissor Sisters. Glenn Matlock. This current episode is Kim Wilde. I just recorded Vince Clark and Jeff Wayne from War of the World.
I'm very jealous of Vince Clark. Very, very jealous. I'm a Basildon boy, and
You know, it's weird. I didn't identify the accent.
I run a club in Essex. Talking about the early sort of synth nights at in Sheffield. I run a club called the Pink Toothbrush in Rayleigh in Essex that used to be called Crocs, and Crocs was the. Well, Depeche Mode were the resident band. Culture Club played their first show there, and Soft Cell come through, and it was one of the early sort of new romantic clubs outside of London. And so Depeche Mode are our absolute hometown heroes, and massive fan of Vince. The work you've done with Vince, obviously, you know, Erasure and you know, the stuff he done with Alison, you know, with Yuzu. It's like, yeah, I'm very jealous of that one. He's I met him once. I met him. I'm club promoter as well in Tan, and I put a night on with Andy Bell called Quiet Life, and it was around the time of, I don't know if you remember, but maybe 10 years ago, Mute done a big weekender at the Rand House in London, and Yuzu reformed and played. And so Vince, yeah. And Vince was in Tan, and he popped down to the night, and it was surreal getting to I was trying my best not to be like a ridiculous fan, but then once I mentioned that I run Crocs and I was from Basel, and that was it. It was like a kind of Coles Corner type thing. It was like, is that still there? I was like, oh yeah, that's still there. It was lovely to sort of you know, somebody that I'd stood in Milton Keynes Bowl with 90,000 people and watched him play live. It was like, he's sitting next to me now, and we're nattering around the video shop that was in Basildon. It was lovely.
He's an incredible lad, and he's like an angel to me. You know, likewise Andy Bell.
Yeah.
I've also worked with Alison Moyer,
yeah,
who is a bit angular, if I'm being honest, but still a lovely person.
Yeah.
But the other people that are coming up are Mal from Cabaret Voltaire.
Oh, wow.
Who's an old friend of mine. Midure.
Superb.
Chris Watson, also from Cabaret Voltaire.
Yeah.
And Johnny Vegas.
Oh, wonderful.
Thomas Dolby, Claudia Brooken. I've got some pretty good people coming up after this one.
I listened to Thomas Dolby on the Adam Buxton podcast.
Yeah.
And my knowledge of Thomas Dolby was She Blinded Me with Science and just, you know, some synth pop stuff from me early years. I did not realise just how much stuff that guy had done. Like, yeah, it was fascinating.
He is a really good musician. He performed with us on the BEF, live BEF shows as well.
Oh, and
right. He did She Blinded Me with Science, which is fantastic.
Oh,
so we got
wonderful.
To play that. And I wanted him to do Wind Power, but I just remember him on Top of the Pops with the wind machine.
Yeah. Oh, superb.
Oh, my God.
Before we wrap things up, Martin, if people want to keep up to speed with everything you're up to, yes. Where's the best place for that?
Okay, hem17.com for mm-hmm. Hem17. Illustriouscompany.co.uk for my 3D soundtrack. It's the 3D soundscape work. My podcast is Electronically Yours with Martin Ware. It's on every podcast platform, pretty much. What else? I'm still doing loads of production. I'm on... Oh, good. I must be the most contactable person on earth, by the way. I'm on Facebook. You don't have to... I've got no secret names. I'm not hidden behind any kind of alter egos. If you just search for my name on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, you know, Instagram. I'm not on TikTok. I'm not going down that path yet.
No, we've got no place on TikTok, Martin. That's for the kids, mate.
It's not for us.
Martin, it's been a real pleasure talking to you today. I really appreciate your time, mate.
All right, man. Thank you.
There you go. What an absolute delight that was. We had a few technical hitches, but we got through it. And so thanks to 76 for getting the scissors out and chopping out the bits where the Wi-Fi dropped out a little bit. This is one of the many things that are coming through this new way of recording and talking over Zoom whilst we're in the situation that we're in. And so I understand and appreciate the fact that you get it, that, you know, we can't all go and sit in lovely studios with a cup of tea and chat face to face at the moment. It's just not something we can do. So we have to use what we've got at our disposal, which is Zoom. And on the whole, it's amazing. But every now and again, the Wi-Fi might drop out. So thanks to 76 for being able to sort of tidy that up and give you the best listening experience you can get from this pod chat. as mentioned again at the beginning, if you enjoyed the chat today, go and have a rummage in the archives. Go and if you like your synth pop, there's a big bundle of synth pop acts that I've chatted to, and yeah, go and have a rummage. There's you'll see a fair few artists in there that we've discussed today, from LaRue to Andy McCluskey from OMD, and many, many more. Go and have a look, and you can find out about all of this stuff at www.offthebeatandtrackpodcast.com. I'm back next time. In the meantime, stay safe. Go and check out all the websites and such that that Martin mentioned. Head over to Spotify and listen to the playlist that that Martin's put together to accompany this chat, and I'll see you next time. Take care. Bye bye.
It's Off the Beaten Track Podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. Keep me, Stu, with him.